Welcome to Driven to Business with your host, Eddie Mayfield. Driven to Business is a business forum program that focuses on success principles in business. And now, it's time for Driven to Business.
Good morning and welcome to this week's edition of Driven to Business. I am your host, as advertised, Eddie Mayfield, and we're glad you're here. We are streaming live, by the way, on biz1190.com, and today's program will be podcast on eddiemayfield.com, and so check that out. We have a great guest today. A lot of us hear about the oil boom in the United States. We read about it. We hear about it. Many of us have invested in it and have been around it. But we have Jay Colquitt today. Jay is the proprietor of a website called oilfieldtrash.com, and he's a worldwide recognized expert and consultant in the oil drilling business. Jay, welcome to Driven to Business.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Jay, I know, having lived in Texas for a while myself, I know that the term oil field trash, to people that know nothing about the oil industry, that might sound like a pejorative or an insult, but it's really not at all, is it?
No, not at all. People are proud to be oil field trash.
Right.
You know, the oil field is the one of the finest industries in the world, and my goodness, to be oil field trash, it's not like trailer trash or pork white trash. You're proud to be oil field trash, you know?
You know, Jay, years ago when I lived in Texas, and this was before cell phones and all that, I was wearing a beeper, and I went to visit a distant relative out there that I didn't really know very well, but I went to her house. And when I walked up with a beeper on, she looked me over as kind of this West Texas woman. She said, "Well, you're either a doctor or oil field trash. Which is it?"
Well, they used to say also, if you had a beeper, you were a drug dealer, because that was the only people that ever wore them.
I told her, "I'm not a doctor." She said, well, "You must be oil field trash."
Yes, sir.
So, what is oil field trash? Is that anybody employed in the oil business?
Well, yes, sir, it really is. It's an attitude is what it is. You know, most people, when they have a job, they've got a job, it's 9 to 5, they go to work, and that's it. But oil field people are not like that. They're oil field people all the time. This is an example, working for Halliburton. When you go to work, you talk about drinking beer and chasing women. When you get off, you talk about Halliburton. Now, that's the way the oil field people do. When they go to work, they talk about anything in the world, but they don't talk about working. And then when they get away from work, then all they talk about was work.
Your website, oilfieldtrash.com, and by the way, that is how you get there, oilfieldtrash.com. You get a lot of hits. And a lot of business people, Jay, are trying very hard to get people to their website, but, man, you get a lot of hits. What advice do you have for those of us trying to get people to our site?
Well, you got to have something that brings them and keeps them. You know, you don't want a website that just has one thing to do. You know, you've got to be able to keep people moving around inside your website. Each individual hit, you've got a unique hit, which is a unique computer calling your website. And then you have what's called hit hits, just regular plain old vanilla hits. And what they are, there's when people move from page to page.
Right.
So they stay on your site longer. And once you can be able to get people to stay, that's where they start making money, that people are moving around. And I have a lot of different things to look at on my website, just on the homepage. I mean, there's financials. I mean, you can see exactly, you know, where the oil and gas prices stay right now, where they are, how many rigs are running in Texas, in the U.S., how many are running in Europe or in the Middle East. It keeps you, you know, you're on Facebook. There's over 12,000 people on Facebook with us. So, I mean, you can instantly say something, write something down, and bingo, 12,000 people have it. So it's certainly worth getting a website that you can move around on and keep people intrigued about what they have.
You know,
we have stories. I've got a deal on there that's called Nearly True Stories. 40 stories. The Nearly True Stories, honestly, is because you can't use a lot of the names, you know. If you said, though, this was Billy Bob Jumpback that did that, well, everybody would say, well, now, Billy Bob's not a very nice boy. Well, I created an imaginary monkey named Bob. So anytime I tell a bad story on somebody, I'm telling it on Bob. I don't tell it on the guy that really did it.
I have been there on Bob's blog. You do write. You write a lot of stuff.
I write a lot of stories, but they're all, well, basically true. They're nearly true.
I have a good friend, Jay, here in town, who's actually been a guest on the program here before, Wyman Barnett. And Wyman always says that you should never let the facts get in the way of a good story.
That's true. You know, one of the very best stories that I like, and it's on the website as well, is called Don't Eat the Gravy. And that's a really, really good story. Do you mind if I say something about it?
No, go ahead, please.
Really quick. This story, I was sent to Zambia to drill a couple of wildcat wells back in the late 80s. And so Penrod Drilling Company had a drilling rig that was not working in the United States, so they moved it to Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, and then we brought it over land, which took 12 days to get into northern Zambia. We got in there, we had a soft camp, which was just tents, you know, and our hard camp was still on the road coming in, but we had everything you could ever dream of that these Cajuns like to eat. And so we're just container after container full of food. Well, we taught a guy, which was the king of the tribe around there. We called him Droopy because he had earlobes that drooped all the way down to his shoulders. He had pulled them, and he had the longest, droopiest ear deals that there ever was, earlobes. And so every time the Cajuns taught him how to make cream gravy. And we had game rangers that would walk around us all the time, and they'd bring us zebra or gazelle or, you know, something to eat all the time. We had really good meat, and this boy could really cook it. And we would eat this cream gravy that the Cajuns taught him how to make, called Droopy how to make, and it had a little crunch to it, and we flat could not figure out what that crunch was. And we'd been eating this stuff for 2 or 3 weeks. It was hot and miserable and late one evening. The Derek man, Daylight Derek guy, got up and he said, "I'm going to go watch Droopy make the gravy." And so he went in there and he came back into the tent and he said, "Don't eat the gravy." What's the matter with it? Well, somebody, back when we rigged the place up, hung a Coleman lantern above the stove. Well, in this area we were in was the tsetse fly belt. That's where all the animals are. That's where the tsetse flies are. And, boy, when they bite you, it's like a wasp stinging you. And that tsetse flies would fly into that Coleman lantern right down in the gravy. Old Ruby he just kept stirring it. You know, it was just fine with him. I guess they had eaten more tsetse flies than they had anything else. But we ate the tsetse flies for 3 weeks. And that time, we actually moved the lantern. And it worked out all right. We didn't eat any more tsetse flies.
Just more protein in the gravy, I guess, is the thing.
There was.
Hey, the oil and gas industry, at least in some circles, is the object of scorn. But you know, I know that I've read some of your writings. America is in many ways, we're an oil-driven economy. And I know you've written and spoken about this, but give us your insights about that.
You know, Eddie, when the oil field works, everybody works.
Right.
You know, and it trickles down all the way. I mean, what about jewelers? You know, how does a jeweler make money? Well, he sells diamonds and gold Rolex watches. And if you don't have anybody buying them, you know, he's not doing anything.
Right.
Well, it trickles down all the way. You've got restaurants, bars, you know, clothing stores. Everything runs off the oil industry and in this part of the world. Because if the oil industry, I mean, gasoline, everything, I mean, you have to have everything, housing. You realize in Odessa, Texas, just a plain old vanilla townhouse is $1,700 a month now.
Right.
Well, they used to be $450, $500, but now it's $1,700. And it's not that they're gouging, it's just that there's that many people coming. You know, there are really that many people coming. I can go and stay in a La Quinta in Dallas for $69. You go to Odessa, Texas, it's $205. You know, that's just how it is. But it is trickled down. Everything is expensive. Everything runs, but everybody has money. A few years ago, we had a boom going in Fort Stockton, Texas. They didn't have enough people to actually work in the restaurants. They had to shut down part of the restaurants, because, you know, shut time down because they didn't have the people to work. Everybody was in the oil field. Everybody was in the oil field.
You know, I hear about that now in places like around North Dakota, Williston area, in that, you know, that oil field up there, that you know, you hear the stories about they're paying $20 an hour to get a guy to work in a McDonald's up there because there's so many, the oil industry is doing so well up there.
Yeah, you can. Everybody has a job. You realize that out in West Texas, they are expecting in the next year, in one more year, to have an additional 200,000 people in West Texas.
Wow.
Now think about that. I mean, you've got Crane, Texas, 5,000 people. Barnhart, Texas. Think about this. Barnhart, Texas had 7 or 8 people living there for the last 40 years. Say 50. There's probably 500 there now.
That's unreal.
Yeah, it really is.
And you don't know this, but I used to... when I was in Houston for a time there, I had West Texas as a sales territory, and I would land in Midland out there at the airport usually and rent a car, and the other side of my territory was like Hobbs, New Mexico. So I've driven all those little towns out there, and it's like you said, you drive through these little towns. Jay, I don't remember the name of the town. You might know this. It was a little small town, and I don't remember the exact population, but as you drove in, the sign there on the road said, welcome to whatever it is, Texas, population, you know, 30 fine people and a few old grouches. That's what it said.
A few old foreheads, I believe is what it said.
Yeah.
Isn't that like Andrews, Texas?
Is that what it is? I couldn't
think it is. And a few old soreheads.
And a few old soreheads. I always thought that was a hilarious sign. And that just has to do with the Texas.
But it's West Texas. That's how it is.
You know, the other thing that always surprised me out there around there is, you know, you have... having not grown up around oil fields, you know, you go out there and there's like a well next to a well next to a well next to a well. I used to think, how in the world are these people, how can you have wells that close together and anybody know whose oil they're getting out of the ground? But it's still like that, and you're still drilling more.
Certainly. You know, you have to file for a permit to drill through the Texas Railroad Commission.
Right.
And you have a plot of land, and, you know, you can find out anywhere where, you know, in the libraries, who owns what part of the land, you know? And so any oil company would go in there and say, okay, this family owns this plot, and we want to lease that from that family. So they would lease that, and then they would go to their geology department and say, okay, we want to be able to drill a well to 12,000 feet here, which most everything worldwide is 12,000 feet as far as production is concerned. And so that's what they do, and they drill that one well. And you can control your drilling where you're drilling straight up and down, or you can go ahead and drill horizontal. You can drill directional wells.
I want to talk after the break. We have a couple of our break here, Jay. I want to talk to you about that and some more, including directional drilling, which is something that fascinates me. So you are listening to Driven to Business. We're talking with Jay Colquitt, a very interesting discussion about the oil business and about business in general. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to Driven to Business. We're glad you're here today. My name is Eddie Mayfield. I'm proud to be your host. We're talking with Jay Colquitt, the proprietor of oilfieldtrash.com, and we're talking about the oil business, have been talking about the oil business out in West Texas primarily, but the oil business is a worldwide business, and it affects everybody in the United States, including those of us here in Atlanta. Jay, right before the break, we were talking about these wells close together, and you were talking about directional drilling. I was going to ask you a little more about that later on, but I think a lot of people are sometimes, I was, when I first found out that they can drill, you know, in the drilling rig doesn't have to go straight down. They drill all kind of directions under that drilling rig to get into where the geologists tell them the oil is.
You know, Eddie, what they're doing today is it's called horizontal drilling.
Right.
Okay, and what you do is you actually drill down, say, to a kickoff point. You drill a vertical hole down to where you want to be. Now, you know that you have a formation because you've drilled a vertical well into it before. So you drill down, and like all these shale plays, it's working right now. So you drill down straight until you just nearly get to it. It'll leave you about 500 feet, and then what you do is you take your your drill string and you start bending it, and you'll take about 500 feet to lay it out into a lateral position. All right? And what you do is you actually take a mud motor, which as you pump through, you're not rotating the drill pipe. What you're doing is rotating the bit itself, but you put that bit at a very, very small angle. And so as you drill, you're not rotating your pipe. What you're doing is you're drilling and opening this thing up to walk sideways. And through, say, you may drill a 15 degrees sideways and then rotate a little bit and then slide and rotate, you know. And you work your way down to where you're drilling. But your drill pipe is still just like regular drill pipe. It's straight. But you go ahead and you make this whole curve, but over a lateral of or over the side of about 500 feet, 600 feet. And so it doesn't hurt your drill pipe. Then you can lay out flat and drill. But the reason for all of this is if you drill one well straight down, you drill into this particular formation, shell formation, and you frack it and do everything you need to do and start producing it, you produce from one well. But as you lay out horizontally, as you lay out there, you can drill 5,000 or 6,000 feet out there, which is a mile. And instead of having those pump jacks side by side like you were talking about earlier, you only have one well to produce from, and it will normally flow. All of this stuff will flow instead of having to put a pump jack on it and pump it out of the hole.
Right. Jay, let's talk for a moment, because your website has a lot to do with this, but let's talk for a moment about jobs in the oil field. Jay, I tell people in our community, young people in our community all the time, that they would do well to look at a career in the oil and gas business. Now, I don't know anyone that's in a better position to discuss that than you. So for any young people that are listening, give us your take on that.
Eddie, it depends on how you want to make a living. You know, it really does. People all over the world, they want to stay close to home where mom and dad are. I always went where the work was.
Right.
You know, I had to. That's, I mean, the way I wanted to live, I mean, I like gold and diamonds and Cadillacs, you know? And so I would go anywhere in the world that it took to go. I've worked now in 53 countries and 33 states. I have spoken as many as seven languages at one time. It's something that I felt like I had to do.
Including West Texas, I would think.
Sir?
Including the West Texas language. You got that
yeah,
one down too.
I can certainly speak West Texas language too. You know, I was sitting in a drilling rig in Saudi Arabia one time, and a guy walked through the door, and he was cussing something worse than anything I'd ever heard. And I said, "Man, where are you from?" And he said, "Odessa." And it comes to find out that, you know, most people that really can cuss, they come from Odessa. They do. But people, the young people now, they need, if they want to make a living, you can do anything you want to do. They need everybody in West Texas. They need people that set up trailer houses for all the people on the locations. They need people to build the locations. They need landmen. They need water haulers. They need drilling rig people, raftabouts, roughnecks, pipeline people. You name it, they can employ everybody and their dog that will come out there and go to work.
You know, I used to have a neighbor. I actually lived in Louisiana for a while, too. And my next-door neighbor was a mud engineer. Now, I didn't know what that was until he explained it to me. But it turns out that's a pretty good job in the oil fields.
It's an excellent job. And it's a job where if you say, let's just say you have a high school education, but, you know, you've got something going for you. You could go to work for a mud company like that, and they will teach you how to be a mud engineer. They'll send you to their own schools. Halliburton does it. I mean, all of the major oil companies or major service companies own a mud company.
Well, tell folks here that probably don't know, what is mud? What do you do with that?
Well, Eddie, when you start drilling, you'll be drilling with fresh water because you've got a fresh water zone under you, which is your town water. And so you've got to drill past that. And then you would set casing, which would be, say, 18 5/8 or something like that.
Right.
Set that, or 13 3/8. Set that casing and cement it in the ground so that you won't pollute those freshwater zones. All right?
Right.
And then you start drilling, and as you're drilling, what keeps the gas and oil down in the formation is the weight of the fluid. And so regular water weighs 8.34 pounds. Brine water is 10 pounder. It should be 10 pounds. You hope it is 10. and you keep drilling down, and the more you drill further down you go, the more apt your formation is to give up something like oil or gas and come into the formation or come into your well bore. And you don't want that because you want to keep everything down. You don't want to, have gas up on the surface. You know, that's called a kick or something like that, a blowout.
Right.
You don't want that. So you weight this material. And the mud man, he is like a chemist. He puts all different types of chemicals in this mud to keep it weighted and keep it where it holds your formation down. And the deeper you go, the higher the mud weights have to be. But it's a real fine balance because if you get your mud weights too high or too thick, the viscosity is too thick, it'll slow down your drilling.
And, that brings me to the next thing I wanted to talk to you about because, being a mud engineer, it does not require a college degree, but it is very skilled work. It's critical work to the oil fields, so they have to have that. And it's very important work, and it's well-paying work. It pays really well. I don't know if you know, there's a guy named John Ratzinger. He's the guy that plays the pig, the voice of the pig in Toy Story, if you've ever seen that or had your kid or grandkids see it. And he was on Cheers before that, but I think it was Cliff on Cheers.
Yeah.
He did he's doing a documentary right now, and I've heard him speak a few times. And what he's trying to, what he talks about a lot is the lack of skill or the declining number of skilled laborers in this country. And he makes his point. He says, in our society, at least in some areas of the country, we have come to disdain skilled labor. And instead, we talk all of our kids into going to college and getting these degrees that for which they're not going to be able to get a job. And as a result, the country, not only does it hurt the country, it actually hurts those kids. Talk about that a moment.
Eddie, I lived in Europe for a long, long time. And in Europe, when you turn 16 years old, your formal education is over. But you have to, you have to learn a skill.
I think it's kind of crucial because I actually see that, Jay, all the time around here. Is it in my community, kids go off to college, they get a degree in whatever, English, history, something like that. They get out of college after being there 4 years. Maybe they're in a lot of debt, or maybe their parents are, and then they cannot get a job. And it seems like it's just an insane situation that perhaps we ought to do something about, and at least encourage them to perhaps look at the skills. Sorry to run you so tight on the break this time, Jay. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to Driven to Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield. We're here every Saturday morning at 11 o'clock here on WAFS, Atlanta's Biz 1190. Be right back. Welcome back to Driven to Business. I'm your host, Eddie Mayfield. We're talking with Jay Colquitt about the oil business and about jobs in the oil business and about, honestly, what a good business it is to do it. Jay, we were talking about, before the break, we were talking about some well-paying jobs in the oil industry. And really, although they do require relocation for the most part, but if young people are willing to work hard, there are a lot of jobs out there they can have. You made a good point of that. I wonder if you'd like to elaborate on that just a bit.
Eddie, then in Europe, I lived in Europe for about 16 years. And over there, your formal education is finished when you're 16 years old. And when that happens, they give you tests and decide what, if you have a lot of math skills and science skills, you go on to the university and you get a degree. But over here in the United States, it's not like that. You graduate high school, and there you are. If you don't have the ability to go to college, what do you do? Well, the oil field will offer a man the opportunity to go to work for like Halliburton or Schlumberger or Nabors Drilling, and you can go in there and they're $100,000 a year jobs. It's hard work, but it is a really, really good job, and they train you as you go. I was, honest to goodness, Eddie, the dumbest guy that ever came out of Rankin High School. And that's the truth. I went to school because my mother wanted me to, to be a dental technician, and I liked it, but I grabbed an associate science degree to be a dental technician. I went to Odessa, Texas, and started working, and I flat could not make a living. I was sitting in a room that was a laboratory, and I built teeth, and it wasn't any fun, and I didn't enjoy my life, and I just had a horrible time, and I quit and went to work right on a drilling rig as the bottom of the bucket. I mean, I was the green worm corner. That was where I was. And I was lead tongs the first day, backup tongs the third day, and I was a derrick hand the third day. And the reason on that, Eddie, because there wasn't anybody else. I was the oldest hand on the rig. And that's the way it is today. They need people, and they need a lot of people to come out there and do it. And the thing about it is that they will teach you. They will get a hold of you and lead you along the garden path and teach you. If you have the capability to learn it, they will teach you.
You know, I read a book many years ago. I think the book's called The Millionaire Next Door, but I'm not sure that's the title of it. I think that's right. But, you know, in there he cited a study done by someone, and it said that it was tracking education versus income. And really the oil field is an anomaly even to this. But in his study, he said that up to or near 100 grand, this is some years ago, that education and income tracked. But and this has nothing to do with the oil fields. This is aside from the oil fields. But above 100 grand, those it did not track. And when you got up to people that made a lot of money, like millions, there was no correlation whatsoever between education. In fact, it was a negative correlation. One of the most underrepresented groups in the millionaires there are PhDs. And it almost goes backwards for a while. But I've often made, as a small business guy in a technical field, you know, we're in the variable frequency drive business, as you know, and DC drive business. But the, you know, a guy coming out of a trade school with any kind of a skill set like that, that can get a job there, will start at what a college grad's going to start at in almost anything. But in a few years, he's probably going to do better than they're doing. And you know, even in the field I'm in, guys make at or near six figures as technicians. And there are a lot of college kids that don't make that. And again, it goes back to what Ratzenberger makes this point too. There's a lot of, because there's a shortage of skills, there's a lot of money in skills. And I think that's what you're talking. And I think there's nowhere that's as apparent as in the oil business. The oil business is the in particular, when you got to get out somewhere in West Texas, or even as we talked a little bit earlier, up in the North Dakota area, where they just can't get enough people to do the work that needs to be done up there. Consequently, they pay a lot of money for people that will do it.
Well, but Eddie, it's all over. It's in Pennsylvania. It's in North Dakota. It's in Wyoming. It's in South Texas. It's in West Texas. It's all over. The opportunities are unlimited. Completely unlimited.
Hey, what are you? I know that African guy's a West Texas guy that I actually read, a guy named Porter Stansberry, that writes on investing, and he makes a big deal about saying that the biggest boom in America's history, even bigger than anything that's ever happened so far, is as the gas boom continues to expand, which he says hasn't even hit yet. We interviewed here on Driven to Business the president of Atlanta Gas Company, and he said they didn't like the word gas and boom in the same sense.
But hey, there's a big reason that gas is not the commodity that it should be, and that is that gasoline is available on every corner.
Right.
You know, and if you could convert all these pickup trucks to gas trucks, they need to have a place where they can refuel. There's some major oil companies that have converted a lot of their vehicles to it, but then they can't even drive the pickups all the way to the house because they don't have the ability to pull over and fill up with LPG, you know, liquid petroleum gas.
But we have found, but I mean, and I know you see this, and I think I use the term oil and gas together, and I guess everybody does to some extent, but apparently from what people tell me and what I read, we have the stores of natural gas that we have in this country are just almost hard to imagine.
Yes, sir, that's true. I mean, we have more gas than what we can do work with. Everybody's been looking for gas of late because the gas prices were so high. Well, now they're not. They're back into the oil business because oil is so high.
Right.
But our main problem with all of this is the capability to refine. due to the EPA and the global warming and all that, we've not been able to build refineries for 15 years. You just update the ones that you have, and that's it. If we had the capability to refine all the oil that we make, we would not have any problems. But we can't. Venezuela, they refine all of theirs. Saudi Arabia refines all theirs. Kuwait refines all theirs. But we don't. And it's because of our government and the way they're set up.
I was going to ask you this, keeping in mind this is a family-friendly radio station. Give us your take, and I already know what it is, but give us your take on the government's push on this green energy and what it's actually doing to the country.
Eddie, it's really the most simple thing that you could ever look at, the way I see it. You know what a pie chart is, all right? Well,
right.
A pie chart, you know, you cut it, and it's a piece of pie. Well, I like a big piece of pie. Well, wind energy draws a straight line from the middle to the side of the pie. Well, nobody's going to get fat off of that. It's a straight line. It is less than 1% of what we actually do. The windmills are a complete waste of time and energy. The solar panels, if you want them on your home and you want to build your own windmill, great. But to put our economy all on that, on wind energy and solar energy, we're way, way, way.
You know, I tell people all the time, we talk about alternative energy, that given that at the moment there is no alternative energy.
No.
To oil and gas. There just isn't. I mean, there's nothing that's that efficient. It's not even in the ballpark with it.
No. It's a straight line on a pie chart. It's nothing.
And the idea of, I'm with you also, you know, people complain about gas prices and they equate it to all these things. Well, one of the reasons gas prices do go up is shortages, and one of the ways you get shortages is we have so few refineries. I don't know if you remember a few years ago when the hurricane hit Houston.
Sure.
and we felt it right, and we had extreme gas lines right here in Houston, in Atlanta, for a few days. That's because almost all of our gasoline comes out of Houston via a pipeline over to here, and when the Houston refinery shut down, Atlanta runs out of gas. But it's so hard for anyone to build a refinery anywhere else, again, because of the red tape that's involved with it. And it's a silly policy. I can't imagine that we don't at some point do something about that. In terms of, what's the biggest challenge you see? I mean, the oil business and gas business is booming. Do you see, what's the biggest challenge you see to the continued boom of that?
Knowledge. I'm serious about this. The transferring knowledge from the old guys to the young guys, being able to teach these people actually what is going on and how it's done.
That's what I was talking earlier about, John Ratzenberger. That's what he says, is that we're losing skills in the United States that we are not replacing. And at some point, and a lot of them are baby boomer skills, and as these baby boomers retire, there's nobody with that skill set to step in and take their place, and consequently, we won't have the skills.
That's right. You know, 30 years ago, when I got in the business, even more than that, 40 years ago, let's just say Halliburton, because I did go to work for Halliburton after I was on a drilling rig.
Right.
But Halliburton, a cementer, had been driving that truck for 15 years before he got to be a cementer, because the cementer would not teach the driver, because he knew that that boy was going to get his job. And that's the truth. And now they went ahead and they try to train these boys that say, if you have an associate science degree or something like that, or a high school diploma, they will actually train you to do these jobs. I met a young man over in Shreveport here not long ago, and he was the lowliest of the lowest hand on the rig, honest to goodness, but he had worked really hard and he was making $110,000 a year. Well, back in the old days, when I would look up lawyers, airplane pilots, you know what kind of money they made? $10,000 a year. And
right.
He's got a lowly roughneck making the same money. Well, they drive Cadillacs. This roughneck can drive a Cadillac, too, if he wants to.
Yeah, exactly. Except some of them may not want to. You never know. They'd prefer pickup trucks, I think, for the most part.
They got Cadillac pickups, too.
Cadillac pickup. You're right. Hey, let's talk. We've got about a minute left in a segment. But, you know, the BP incident in the Gulf got huge publicity up here and everywhere else. But, you know, the fact of the matter is those things are very, very rare. There's a lot of safety to stop that from happening. Can you tell us in just about a minute what that is?
Well, it's real hard to tell you in just a minute, Eddie, but basically, there's backup systems for everything. and you have to test everything. And once you've tested it, you're going down in the bottom of the ocean. You're 10,000 feet away from, you know, from the surface. You've got all the gauges, everything telling you. And when you run these backup checks, if they don't back up, you've got to pull it back out of the ground, and it takes a lot of money bringing it back up to surface so you can work on it. And that was the problem with BP. They had a problem on the bottom of the ocean, and they thought, well, it's going to be okay. Well, it wasn't. I was actually contacted to be an expert witness in the trials that were going on.
Oh.
And then they decided not to do that, so I didn't do that. But it was really, really bad. Anytime you lose anybody, it's bad.
Oh, sure.
You know, I worked with Red Adair for a long time, and Red told me, he's always said, and he did, and he's gone now, but he said, you know, I've never killed anybody. Now, we've had people, you know, die on location, you know, but it wasn't something that Red did. You know, it was something that you know, some hot shot forklift driver ran over somebody or you know, turned too fast, and it turned the forklift over and killed him. That's the kind of people that...
Yeah. For those that don't know Red Adair, you know, there's a movie called Hellfighters about him, just starring John Wayne. Hey, we'll be back in just a moment with a final segment of Driven to Business. Stick around. Welcome back to the final segment of Driven to Business for this week. By the way, as a reminder, we are streaming live on biz1190.com, and the show is podcast on eddiemayfield.com, along with other information about the show. By the way, you can find links to Jay and his business on eddiemayfield.com. Just go there, go to the blog section, you'll find it there, or on the podcast, and it'll be there. Jay, we've been talking a lot about the oil business. You're very passionate about it. I am too. You know, in our company, we're not directly involved with the drilling as you have been. We are more on the production side of it, and we provide services in the oil field. And I want to talk just a moment about that, because there's a lot of business to be done in services around the oil field. I think I told you this before. When I lived in Texas, people used to say that, if when you heard someone talking about how many barrels of oil was being produced in a field or something, it was a good position to be in to be the guy selling the barrels. What they're basically saying was there's a lot of service businesses to be done, whether you're an electronic motor drive business like we are, or a truck driver, or an equipment supplier, whatever. But it produces its own economy, doesn't it, when you have a producing field?
Yes, sir. You know, the people that make the bulk of the money are the landowners. You know, I had a friend named Calvin out in West Texas. He told me one time, as long as oil's above $75 a barrel, I'm happy. You know, but that's not where it starts. Landmen have to be there. You know, every kind of discipline that you could ever dream of are needed in that situation everywhere.
Hey, people say that we're producing more oil and gas than ever before. Jay, is that true?
Yes, sir, it is. It sure is. We even export a lot of oil. We export as much because we can't refine it. That's the same thing we spoke about earlier. We don't have the ability to refine the oil and gas that we have.
I mean, exporting is fine if we're making money at it, but it does seem to be kind of crazy that if we are some sort of an artificial shortage of gasoline, and we don't have one right now, but we have had them, and at the same time, we're actually exporting because we don't have the refining capacity. Why are we, I guess I know the answer to this, but why are we producing so much oil and gas right now? What's happened to change that?
Prices. You know, we've got the ability to drill inexpensively and be able to get the oil up under the price of what oils are selling for.
So basically what you're saying, it's a free market thing. As long as there's a market for it, people will find a way to get it out of the ground.
Yes, sir.
Hey, talk to us real quick, because this is a term that a lot of people use, fracking. Tell us about fracking.
Fracking is a way to create a hydraulic earthquake. And what you actually do is you fracture the rock under pressure. And when you do that, you are pumping fluids into it at a high pressure. You break the rock by the hydraulic pressure. And when you send some gel fluid, that's just like Jell-O, you pump that down the hole, but carrying sand or some type of a propant like iron bauxite.
Right.
and this sand and gel go down into the well bore, and then they go to out these cracks that you've created. And as the cracks fill up with sand, the fluid continues on. The sand goes into where the cracks are, and when you release the pressure, the cracks can't go all the way closed again. Therefore, it opens up the well so that it can bring more and more oil and gas to the surface.
That is a great explanation. I had read this recently, exactly how that works, and they said what you just said, but they went into like a whole chapter of a book and a lot more complicated, but yours is a lot better explanation, I think, than what I...
Well, good.
You're going to be a good teacher.
That's honest to goodness.
Hey, you've been in the oil business a long time now, and you've been around it forever. What's the biggest change you've seen in recent years in the oil fields?
Safety. Safety is the key right there, and that's the key to success. If you can do it safely and not kill anybody and everybody gets to go home, you did a good job. Because there's absolutely, I'm telling you, there's not an oil well on this earth is worth dying for.
Right.
And I know, because I have, honest to goodness, nearly killed myself trying to make somebody else a dollar, and I don't have to do that. I do not have to kill myself to make it. You just don't. And we every day, that's the main thing you do on a drilling rig is you make sure everybody knows what their assignments are, and you pay attention to what's going on. You use forklifts. You use man lifts. You use all different types of equipment that keeps you from hurting your back or your legs or breaking your arm or something like that. You always want to make sure that everybody goes home in the same shape they got there in.
You know, it's not just mechanical things hurt people that you're talking about. There's also things like poison gas can come out of a well. All sorts of things can happen that you have safety methods built into to take care of.
Yes, sir, you do. For poison gas, you have monitors all over the drilling rig, out on the shell shakers, underneath the substructure, all over. And people even wear badges on their shirts. You know that, and fire retardant FRC
right.
clothing,
right?
And you also have this H2S monitors. And anytime a monitor goes off, you pull everybody away from it. You know, you get in there and you say, okay, well, why is it going off? Well, obviously we've got a high signal. So what we'll have to do is bring out the experts and have them go in and see if it's true or if it's a faulty monitor.
You know, we've had to go on a couple of offshore oil. Well, I've been on a couple of, four, I guess, offshore oil platforms. And, you know, before you go on there, of course, you know this, you have to sit down and go through what amounted to about a two-hour safety class.
Yes, sir.
Part of which is learning how to put your respiratory gear on and all that kind of stuff. Now, after I did it a while, I had a certificate, you know, after I'd done it enough times, I had a certificate that basically let me show that certificate, and I still had to go through a short one even then to get on there. But, you know, these were platforms that did have a lot of it's hydrogen sulfide, I guess.
Yes, sir.
Gas that again, the sour eggs smell and all that kind of stuff to teach you to be safe with that, to recognize it, and also something, you know, they teach us heavier in the air and what to do and pay attention to the way the wind's blowing and all that sort of stuff. You've already been over this a little bit right here. You've had a great career, and you said, you know, you were start off as a dental technician, and you got over into the oil business. Was there anything particular that pushed you to the oil business, or you just were bored at being a dental, at building teeth?
I wanted to be outside. I wanted to be able to look out a window, and I didn't have one. And the money as well. The money turned out to be just, you know, unbelievable. And I've, like I say, I've worked all over the world. I've been broke, still broke sometimes. You know, that's the way oil people are. That's part of being oil field trash. When the boom's booming, you are too. And when it goes downhill, you go with it. You know, but a lot of people, that's what's happened to the knowledge, is a lot of the people didn't come back. They didn't stay. They didn't come back to the oil field when they had the opportunity. They stayed working at Walmart or wherever they had to stay.
Jay, my first experiences in the oil field was I was doing field service on submersible pump drives back in the days of long ago. And I was sitting out. I remember sitting in a rain one time. This guy, the well owner, and I were sitting there. And I was just sitting in his truck waiting for it to quit raining where we could finish. I didn't want to open the cabinet and get the electronics wet. And we're just shooting the breeze with a guy. This is an old country boy, just a nice going guy. And I forgot his name was Mac or something like that. And he just said, he's telling me about his life, and he grew up as a rancher and all this kind of stuff. And he said, you know, I made $3 million last year. He said, that's not bad for a country boy, is it? And I said, I don't think that's bad for any kind of boy, actually. Just amazing sitting out there with it. Hey, what's really important to Jay Colquitt in about a minute we have left here? Or I guess another way to say, how does Jay want to be remembered?
I want to be remembered as a teacher. I really do. I want people to say, Jay taught me how to do this. Jay taught me how to do that. I remember what Jay said. And what way I do teach is I try to teach by examples of things that are commonplace. Whether, like, I use a gallon of milk, an imaginary gallon of milk, and get a gallon of milk in your hand, and I tell those roughnecks, throw it out there in the pits, and let's follow that gallon of milk all the way around so you trace the fluid on the drilling rig. So you know where all that fluid goes. Once you know that, you can be a driller. And it can save you 2 years. That's one of the main things I do. Another one is the gas bottle out on your gas grill. If you shake it, you can feel that fluid inside. Well, why is it liquid? Because when you open it up, it's
gas. It evaporates out of there. You are a good teacher. You have great examples. Jay, thanks so much for being a guest today. I really enjoyed having you on the program. I hope to have you on here again.
Glad I could do it. I'm really glad I could do it. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. So you have been listening to Driven to Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield, and we'll see you again next week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Driven to Business with your host, Eddie Mayfield. Visit next Saturday at 11 a.m. on Biz 1190 for more Driven to Business. To learn more about Driven to Business, visit eddiemayfield.com or call 770-448-4644.